Hi, this is Evan Karish, Editor-in-Chief of Anesthesiology, with some highlights from the August 2020 issue, as selected by the journal editors. We begin this month with an assessment of the analgesic effects and adverse effects of the perioperative use of the gabapentinoids, gabapentin, and pregabalin in adult patients. Dr. Michael Verrett of Université Laval, Quebec City, Quebec, and colleagues there and elsewhere in Canada conducted a systematic review and meta-analysis. The primary outcome was the intensity of postoperative acute pain and a minimally important difference of 10%. The authors analyzed 280 clinical trials that included nearly 25,000 patients. They found that gabapentinoids were associated with a 9% less postoperative pain intensity at various time intervals compared to controls. That was statistically significantly less. However, this effect was not clinically significantly less. These results were consistent for both gabapentin and pregabalin. The use of gabapentinoids was associated with a decreased risk of postoperative nausea and vomiting. However, patients experienced more dizziness and visual disturbances. There was no effect on the prevention of postoperative chronic pain, but there was an increased risk of adverse events. These results do not support the routine use of pregabalin or gabapentin for the management of postoperative pain in adult patients. Our next clinical study investigated whether burst suppression during cardiopulmonary bypass mediates the effects of known delirium risk factors on postoperative delirium. Dr. Juan Piedemonte of Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston and colleagues there and elsewhere conducted the study. This was a retrospective cohort observational sub-study of the minimizing ICU neurological dysfunction with dexmedetomidine-induced sleep, or MINDDS trial. The authors analyzed data from 159 cardiac surgery patients who were older than 60. They used regression analyses to assess for associations and causality. They also used a validated questionnaire to evaluate delirium risk factors. The authors also analyzed electroencephalogram data for most of the patients. The incidence of delirium in patients with burst suppression was 25%. In contrast, 6% of the patients without burst suppression experienced delirium. In constructing a multivariable model for burst suppression, the authors identified physical function, lowest cardiopulmonary bypass temperature, and electroencephalographic alpha power as predictors. They found that burst suppression and patient age emerged as predictors in the delirium multifactorial multivariable model. Piedemonte and co-workers concluded that there is evidence that burst suppression during cardiopulmonary bypass mediates the effect of physical function and temperature during cardiopulmonary bypass. Burst suppression may also mediate intraoperative electroencephalogram alpha power effects on postoperative delirium. Our next clinical study aimed to quantify the effects of phenylephrine and ephedrine on cerebral blood flow and cerebral metabolic rate of oxygen in brain tumor patients. Dr. Klaus Koch and colleagues at Aarhus University Hospital, Aarhus, Denmark, conducted the study. The authors tested the hypothesis that phenylephrine reduces cerebral metabolic rate of oxygen in selected brain regions compared with ephedrine. In this double-blind clinical trial, 24 anesthetized patients with brain tumors were randomized to treatment with either ephedrine or phenylephrine. Before and during vasopressor infusion, the authors performed positron emission tomography measurements of cerebral blood flow and cerebral metabolic rate of oxygen. They scanned both peritumoral and normal contralateral regions of the brain. The authors found no intergroup differences in the peritumoral cerebral metabolic rate of oxygen values before and after vasopressor. Similarly, there were no intergroup differences in the contralateral hemisphere cerebral metabolic rate of oxygen. Ephedrine significantly increased cerebral blood flow and regional cerebral oxygen saturation in the contralateral hemisphere compared to phenylephrine. The change in oxygen extraction fraction in both regions were comparable between groups. The authors concluded that the cerebral metabolic rate of oxygen changes in peritumoral and normal contralateral regions were similar between ephedrine and phenylephrine-treated patients. In the normal contralateral region, ephedrine was associated with an increase in cerebral blood flow and regional cerebral oxygen saturation compared with phenylephrine. Our next clinical study set out to quantify the incidence of substance use disorder among anesthesiologists. Dr. David O. Warner of the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota, conducted this retrospective cohort study. They analyzed data from the American Board of Anesthesiology and the National Death Index regarding either a report to a certifying body or death in physicians after the completion of anesthesiology training. They determined that 600 of nearly 45,000 physicians had evidence of substance use disorder following training. The overall incidence was 0.75 per 1,000 physician years. The incidence was nearly twice as high among men compared with women. The authors concluded that the estimated cumulative 30-year incidence of substance abuse among graduates of U.S. residency programs is about 1.6%. Opioids and alcohol are the most commonly abused substances. Nearly 20% of those with substance use disorder had died from it at last follow-up. The risk of relapse was approximately 40% among survivors. Next, we have a small clinical study that tested the hypothesis that an enhanced recovery pathway improves quality of recovery after 1 to 2 level lumbar fusion. Dr. Ellen Soffin and colleagues at Weill Cornell Medical College, New York, conducted the double-blind study. They randomized 56 patients to receive either usual care or enhanced recovery care. Enhanced recovery consisted of 17 evidence-based, pre, intra, and post-operative care elements. The primary outcome was the quality of recovery 40 score at post-operative day 3. The authors found statistically significantly higher quality of recovery 40 scores in the enhanced recovery group. However, the difference did not meet the predetermined measure of clinical significance. There were no statistically or clinically significant differences in quality of recovery scores at days 0 1, 2, 14, or 56. Some secondary endpoints were statistically different in the enhanced recovery pathway. These included time to oral intake, duration of patient-controlled analgesia use, and opioid consumption on postoperative day 1, but not postoperative day 2. The authors concluded that enhanced recovery strategies for spinal surgery did not have a clinically significant impact. Next, we have a rat study in which the authors tested the hypothesis that dorsal root ganglion stimulation is effective in reducing pain-like behaviors in chronic pain models in animals. Dr. Guiling Yu of the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and colleagues there and at the first affiliated hospital of Zhengzhou University, Zhengzhou City, Henan, China, conducted the study. The authors provided dorsal root ganglion stimulation or direct spinal cord stimulation to rats that had either traumatic neuropathy via a tibial nerve injury or knee osteoarthritis induced by intraticular articular injection of monosodium iodoacetate. Control rats had no injury. The authors evaluated analgesia by testing a battery of pain-related reflexive, functional, and affective behaviors. In rats with nerve injury, multilevel L4 and L5 ganglion stimulation decreased hypersensitivity to noxious mechanical stimulation more than single-level ganglion stimulation at L4. In rats with osteoarthritis, multilevel L3 and L4 ganglion stimulation reduced sensitivity to knee motion more than stimulation at L3 or L4. The authors concluded that dorsal root ganglion stimulation is effective in neuropathic and osteoarthritic rat pain models with peripheral pathogenic origins. The study demonstrates the effectiveness of ganglion stimulation in a placebo-free setting and suggests that this model may be a suitable platform for mechanistic studies. Our clinical focus review article this month examines the perioperative management of oral glucose-lowering drugs in patients with type 2 diabetes. Dr. Jean-Charles Presser of Erasmus Hospital in Brussels, Belgium, and colleagues there and the Free University of Brussels authored this review. They review the major categories of drugs to treat type 2 diabetes. These include those that inhibit endogenous hepatic glucose production, like the first-line drug metformin, those that lower blood glucose by increasing insulin release, those lowering glycemia by increasing insulin action, those reducing glucose absorption, and those increasing urinary glucose elimination. They summarize current recommendations for each drug class in patients having surgery. In the case of scheduled surgical procedures, previous guidelines recommended withholding oral glucose-lowering drugs. Based on recent literature, this tendency has shifted toward the continuation of treatment. In most cases, the continuation of glucose-lowering drugs seems safe, although treatment interruption on the day of surgery may be recommended due to fasting, reduced food intake, or risk of renal dysfunction. The authors note that inadvertent discontinuation may worsen glycemic control and increase complication rates. Additionally, the inappropriate continuation of sulfonylurea or sodium glucose cotransporter 2 inhibitors may induce hypoglycemia or ketoacidosis. And finally, we close this month with a review article that addresses mineralocorticoid dysfunction during critical illness. Dr. Gladness DiCaolo Nathati of the University of the Witwatersrand, Johannesburg, South Africa, and colleagues there and elsewhere in South Africa and in Australia wrote this review. They note that the role of the mineralocorticoid axis in critical illness has recently received renewed interest. They attribute this interest to the recent demonstration of the significant reduction in mortality in patients with septic shock treated with adjunctive glucocorticoids combined with fludrocortisone. Additionally, the effectiveness of angiotensin II in treating vasodilatory shock has sparked renewed interest. The authors note that glucocorticoids have variable interactions at the mineralocorticoid receptor. Similarly, mineralocorticoid receptor aldosterone interactions differ from mineralocorticoid receptor glucocorticoid interactions, and predicate receptor ligand interactions evoke different cellular effects. Hyperreninemic hypoaldosteronism associated with a high mortality rate has been previously described in critically ill patients with shock. Variable plasma concentrations of aldosterone are seen in critical illness, as well as an impaired adrenal aldosterone response to increased levels of renin. However, the assessment of hypoaldosteronism, as well as the role of mineralocorticoid replacement in the critically ill, remains a challenge. Additionally, the effect of angiotensin II in shock states remains untested. Whether mineralocorticoid deficiency exists as a relevant pathophysiologic entity in critical illness and the role of fludrocortisone treatment remain unknown. Thank you for joining me for this brief exploration of the exciting work being done in anesthesiology. I'll be back in just a few weeks with highlights from the September issue.